Look, look, Sal. And I pointed eagerly. Beyond the central figure was an army of stick figures that followed the king. They weren't executed in such detail, but the swords and helmets were unmistakable. And look there! And Sally directed the beam of the torch onto a row of white-robed figures that stood at the king's feet. Tiny figures, perhaps 9 inches tall. Priests, perhaps. And, oh, Ben, look, look! She played the beam across the stern canvas, and for a moment I didn't recognize it. And then my heart jumped. Like a huge frieze that was obliterated in places by moisture, moss, and lichens, or that was obscured by the myriad figures of men and animals drawn over it, and that yet managed to maintain its imposing majesty and power, swept the drawing of a stone fortress wall. It was built in blocks, with the joints clearly shown, and along its summit was the decorative pattern of chevrons, identical to the one that graces the main temple wall at the ruins of Zimbabwe. Beyond the wall rose outlines of the phallic towers we'd expected to find. It's our city, Ben. It's our lost city. And our lost king, Sally, and his priests and warriors. And oh, my God, Sally, look at that. Elephants, she squealed. A war elephants, with arches on their backs, just like Hannibal used against the Romans. Carthaginian. Phoenician. There was so much of it. A curved wall 100 feet long and 10 to 15 feet high, and every square inch of it thick with Bushman paintings. The figures and forms were interwoven, some of the earlier pictures overlaid and smothered. Others, like our white king, standing proudly, untouched and unspoilt. It would be a major undertaking to unravel those portraits which related to our lost civilization from the great mass of traditional cave art. This was Sally's special skill. My camera could only capture the whole confused scene, while she would patiently and painstakingly pick out a figure or a group of particular interest that was almost entirely obliterated and recreate and restore it on her rolls of wax paper. However, there was no suggestion of such work beginning now. Sally and I spent what was left of the day climbing and crawling along the back wall, peering and probing, and exclaiming with wonder and delight. When we got into camp that night, we were physically and emotionally exhausted. Peter Larkin had a message for us from Lauren. He says to wish you good luck, and that one of the oil helicopters will be in your area within the next few days. Anything you need, if so, give me a list. They'll drop it to you. The next 10 days were the happiest of my entire life. The helicopter came, as Lauren had promised, with the name Stuyvesant Oil blazoned across its fuselage. It carried a full load of necessities and luxuries for us. Another tent, folding chairs, a surveyor's theodolite, gas for the lamps, food, extra clothing for both of us, more paper and paints for Sally, film for me, and even a few bottles of Glen Grant malt whiskey, that sovereign specific for all the ills of man. A note from Lauren enjoined me to carry on with what I was doing as long as it looked promising. He would give me his full support, but I was not to keep him in the dark too long, as he was dying of curiosity. I sent him my thanks, a roll of film showing the paintings which had no ancients in them, and a batch of polythene bags containing samples of pigments from the cavern for carbon-14 dating. Then the helicopter flew away and left us to our idyll. We worked from early each morning until dark each evening, mapping the cavern in plan and elevation, and photographing an overlapping run of the walls and relating this to our map. Sally alternated between assisting me and continuing with her own task of isolating our ancient figures. We worked in complete harmony and understanding, breaking off now and then to eat our lunch beside the emerald pool, or to swim naked together in its cool, limpid water, or at times just to lie idly on the rocks and talk. At first, our occupation of the cavern seriously affected the ecology of the local fauna. But, as we hoped would happen, they soon adapted. Within days, the birds were dropping down through the hole in the cavern roof to drink and bathe at the edge of the pool. Soon they ignored us as they went about their noisy and vigorous ablutions, shrieking and chattering and spraying water, while we paused in our labors to watch them. Even the monkeys, driven by thirst, at last crept in through the rock passage to snatch a mouthful of water before darting away again. Rapidly, these timid forays became bolder, until at last they were a positive nuisance, stealing our lunch or any loose equipment that was left unguarded. We forgave them, for their antics were always appealing and entertaining. They were wonderful days of satisfying work, good, loving companionship, and the deep peace of that beautiful place. There was only one day on which anything happened to ruffle the surface of my happiness. As Sally and I were sitting below the portrait of our wonderful white king, I said, "They won't be able to deny this, Sal. The bastards are going to have to change their narrow little minds now." She knew I was talking about the debunkers, the special pleaders, the politico-archaeologists who could twist any evidence to fill the needs of their own beliefs, the ones who had castigated me and my books. "Oh, don't be so certain of that, Ben," Sally warned. "They will not accept this. I can hear their carping little voices now. It's second-hand observation by Bushmen, open to different interpretations. Don't you remember, Ben, how they accused the Abbey Bray of retouching the paintings in the Brandenburg?" "Yes, that's the great pity of it. It is second-hand. When we show them the paintings of the fortified walls, they'll say, 'Yes, but where are the walls themselves?'" "And our king," and she looked up at him, "our beautiful, virile warrior king. They'll emasculate him. He'll become another white lady. His war shield will become a bouquet of flowers. His milky white skin will change to ceremonial clay. His fiery red beard will suddenly turn into a scarf or a necklace. And when they reproduce his portrait, it'll be subtly altered in all those ways. The Encyclopedia Britannica will still read," and she changed her voice, mimicking a pedantic and pompous lecturer, "'Modern scientific opinion is that the ruins are the work of some Bantu group, possibly the Shona or Makalang.'" "I wish, oh, how I wish we had found some definite proof," I said miserably. I was facing for the first time the prospect of delivering our discovery to my learned brothers in science, and the idea was as appealing as climbing into a pit full of black mambas. I stood up. "Oh, let's have a swim, Sal." We swam side by side, an easy breaststroke back and forth across the pool. When we climbed out to sit in the spot of bright sunlight that fell from the roof above, I tried to alleviate my unhappiness by changing the subject. I touched Sally's arm, and with all the finesse of a wounded rhinoceros, I blurted out, "Will you marry me, Sally?" She turned a startled face to me, her cheeks and eyelashes still bejeweled with water droplets. And she stared at me for fully 10 seconds before she began to laugh. "Oh, Ben, you funny old-fashioned thing. This is the 20th century. Just because you've done me wrong doesn't mean you have to marry me." And before I could protest or explain, she had stood up and dived once again into the emerald pool. For the rest of that day, she was completely occupied with her paints and brushes, and she had no time even to look in my direction, let alone talk to me. The message was received, my end, loud and clear. There were some areas of discussion that Sally had put the death curse on. Matrimony was one of them. It was a very bad day, but I learnt the lesson well and decided to clutch at what happiness I now had without pressing for more. That evening, Larkin had another message from Lauren. "Your samples 1 to 16. Give C14 average result of 1620 years plus or minus 100. Congratulations, looks good. When do I get in on the secret? Loren. I perked up at this news. Assuming our old Bushman artist had been an eyewitness of the subjects he had drawn, then somewhere between A.D. 200 and A.D. 400, an armed Phoenician warrior had led his armies and war elephants across this beloved land of mine. I felt guilty about excluding Lorin from the secrets of the cavern, but it was still too soon. I wanted to have it to myself a little longer, to gloat upon it, to have its peace and beauty to myself, unsullied by other eyes. And more than that, it had become the temple of my love for Sally. Like the old Bushman, it had become a very holy place to me. On the following day, it was as though Sally was determined to make up for the unhappiness she had caused me. She was teasing and loving and mischievous all at once. At noon, with the beam of sunlight burning down on us, we made love on the rocks beside the pool. Sally skillfully and gently taking the initiative once again. It was a shattering and mystic experience that scarred the sadness from the cup of my soul and filled it to the brim with happiness and peace. We lay together, softly entwined, murmuring sleepily, when suddenly I was aware of another presence in the cavern. Alarm flared through me, and I struggled up on one elbow and looked to the entrance tunnel. A golden-brown human figure stood in the gloomy mouth of the tunnel. He was dressed in a short leather loincloth, a quiver and short bow stood up behind his shoulder, and around his neck hung a necklace of ostrich eggshell beads and black monkey beans. The figure was tiny, the size of a 10-year-old child, but the face was that of a mature man. Slanted eyes and high, flat cheekbones gave it an Asiatic appearance, but the nose was flattened, and the lips were full and voluptuously chiselled. The small domed skull was covered by a pelt of tight black curls. For an instant we looked into each other's eyes, and then, like the flash of a bird's wing, the little mannequin was gone, vanished into the dark passage in the rock. "What is it?" Sally stirred against me. "Bushman," I said, "here in the cavern, watching us." She sat up quickly and peered fearfully about her. "Where?" "He's gone now. Get dressed, quickly." "Is he dangerous, Ben?" Her voice was husky. "Yes, very." I was pulling on my clothes quickly, trying to decide on our best course of action, running over in my mind the words I would speak. Although it was a little rusty, I found the language was still on my tongue, thanks to sessions of practice with Timothy McGeeber. They would be northern bushmen here, not Kalahari. The languages were similar but distinctly different. They wouldn't attack us, would they, Ben? Sally was dressed. If we do the wrong thing now, they will. We don't know how holy this place is to them. We mustn't frighten them. They've been persecuted and hunted for 2,000 years. "Oh, Ben." She moved closer to me, and even in my own alarm, I enjoyed her reliance upon me. They wouldn't kill us, would they? "Sally, they're wild bushmen. If you threaten or molest a wild thing, it will attack you. I've got to get an opportunity to talk to them." I looked around for something to use as a shield, something strong enough to turn a reed arrow with a poison tip. Poison that would inflict a lingering but certain death of the most unspeakable agony. I selected the leather theodolite case and tore it open along the seams with my hands, flattening it out to give it maximum area. "Follow me down the passage, Sal, and keep close." Her hand was on my shoulder as I led her slowly along the rock passage, using the 4-cell torch to search every dark corner and recess before moving on. The light alarmed the bats, and they fluttered and squeaked about our heads. The grip of Sally's hand on my shoulder became painfully tight. But we reached the tree trunk that guarded the entrance to the cavern. We crouched by the narrow slit between rock and tree trunk, and the bright sunlight beyond was painful to my eyes. Minutely I examined each tree trunk in the grove, each tuft of grass, each hollow or irregularity of earth, and there was nothing. But they were there, I knew, hidden, waiting with the patience and concentration of the earth's most skillful hunters. We were prey. There was no escaping this fact. The accepted laws of behavior did not apply out here on the fringe of the Kalahari. I remembered the fate of the crew of a South African Air Force Dakota that force-landed in the desert 10 years before. They hunted down the family of bushmen that did it. And I flew to Gaborone's to interpret at the trial. In the dock they wore the parachute silk as clothing, and their faces were childlike, trusting, without guilt or guile, as they answered my question. "Yes, we killed them," they said. Locked in a modern jail, like caged wild birds, they were dead within 12 months, all of them. The memory was chilling now, and I thrust it aside. "Now listen to me carefully, Sally. You must stay here. No matter what happens, I will go to them, talk to them. If," and I choked on the words and cleared my throat, "if they hit me with an arrow, I'll have half an hour or so before..." I rephrased the sentence. "I'll have plenty of time to get the Land Rover and come back for you. You can drive. You'll have no trouble following the tracks we made back to the Marakihari Pan. Ben, don't go. Oh, God, Ben, please. They'll wait, Sal, until dark. I have to go now, in the daylight. Ben, wait here. Whatever happens, wait here." I shrugged off her hands and stepped to the opening. "Peace," I called to them in their own tongue. "There is no fight between us." I took a step out into the sunlight. "I am a friend." Another slow step, down over the twisted roots of the wild fig, holding the flattened leather case low against my hip. "Friend," I called again, "I am of your people. I am of your clan." I went slowly down into the silent, hostile grove. There was no response to my words, no sound nor movement. Ahead of me lay a fallen tree. I began sidling towards it, my guts a hard, tight ball of tension and fear. "I carry no weapon," I called. And the grove was quiet and sinister in the hush of afternoon. I'd almost reached the fallen tree when I heard the twang of the bowstring, and I dived for the shelter of the dead trunk. Close beside my head, the arrow fluted, humming in the silence, and I went down. My face was pressed into the dry earth, my heart frozen with fear at the close passage of such hideous death. I heard footsteps running from behind me, and I rolled over on my side, ready to defend myself. Sally was running down the wild fig roots towards me, ignoring my instructions, her face a pale mask of deathly terror, her mouth open in a silent scream. She had seen me fall and lie still, and the thought of me dead had triggered her panic. Now, as I moved, she realized her mistake, and she faltered in her run, suddenly aware of her own vulnerability. "Get back, Sal," I yelled. "Get back!" Her uncertainty turned to dismay, and she stopped, stranded halfway between the cavern entrance and my dead tree trunk, undecided on which way to move. In the edge of my vision, I saw the little yellow bushman rise from a patch of pale grass. There was an arrow notched to his bow, and the feathered flights were drawn back to his cheek as he aimed. He was 50 paces from where Sally hovered, and he held his aim for a second. I dived forward across the space that separated Sally from me at the instant the bushman released the arrow. The arrow and I flew on an interception course, two sides of a triangle, with Sally at the apex. I saw the humming blur of the arrow flash in belly-high at Sally, and I knew I could not reach her before it struck. I threw the flattened leather case with the despairing underhand flick of my wrist as I dived towards her. It cartwheeled lazily, spinning in the air, and the arrow slapped into it. The deadly iron tip with the poison-smeared barbs bit into the tough leather of the case. Arrow and case fell harmlessly at Sally's feet, and I picked her up in my arms and, spinning on my heels, doubled up under her weight, I raced back towards the cover of the dead tree trunk. The bushman was still on his knees in the grass ahead of me. He reached over his shoulder and pulled another arrow from his quiver. In one smoothly practiced movement, he had notched and drawn. This time there was no hope of dodging, and I ran on grimly. The bowstring sang, the arrow flew, and instantly I felt a violent jerk at my neck. I knew I was hit, and with Sally still in my arms, we fell behind the dead tree trunk. "I think I'm hit, Sal." I could feel the arrow dangling against my chest as I rolled away from her. "Break off the shaft, but don't try and pull it out against the barbs." We lay facing each other, our eyes only a few inches apart. Strangely, now that I was a dead man, I felt no fear. The thing was done. Even if I was hit a dozen times more, my fate would be unaltered. It only remained to get Sally safely away before the poison did its work.